Amici del Buddha, amici del Dharma, amici del Sangha. Okay, good morning. So, habitually, as we move through the world, we're moving through a web of relations, right? Everything that our attention lands on somehow, some way, relates to us. And, you know, it might be about us. You know, as social animals, we burn a fair amount of energy on noticing and imagining what he, she, they might think and feel about us. It may be, you know, a positive or negative feeling about something, craving, appreciation, anxiety, hope, lots of possibilities. This habit of perceiving that everything somehow relates to me is useful in context, but it's not the most clear picture of reality. Thank you. Today I want to get at how this happens in terms of how we're how we perceive the Buddha Dharma and what we can do to loosen that view and take a larger perspective. So because of ignorance, the fundamental distortion that we make of imagining a separate, limited existence, lasting self nature, is mostly what we're orienting to. Most of what we encounter is actually versions of or facets of ourself. In Sanskrit, we're talking about vipaka, the vipalkain of sankharas, right? So all intentional action, whether that's body, speech, or mind, anything that has that motive force behind it, creates sankhara, right? Produces karmic seeds. And at some point, those seeds fruit. You know, they ripen, and that is, and with that ripening, it impacts new consciousness, and that's vipaka. So different traditions in Buddhism describe the fine print differently, like where those seeds are stored and what actually causes them to fruit. But that basic outline is common across Buddhist traditions. This phenomenon of substituting pieces of past experience to fill in for present experience is, you know, we do it because it's sufficient, but it's less accurate than encountering the world without that sort of a filter. It's kind of like our mind's version of copy and paste. You know, we right-click on some portion of experience that we've had in the past. We have a clear picture of it, like the sensation of disappointment, right? And then we paste it onto a new target, if it seems like a plausible fit. That plausible fit is about how we perceive, how we interpret the situation, right? But that in itself is a replay of, you know, the amalgamation of all this residue of thousands of previous experiences. So I'm giving a Dharma talk and I see a little tiny square up there and someone's, you know, eyebrows flicker and, you know, I interpret that as, some kind of, you know, frustration or disappointment or confusion. And, you know, that's my pasting on of, I guess I'm not making sense. You know, they think I'm babbling from past interactions. And as that happens, as that perceptual and cognitive transfer from the past happens, it's an intentional action and it conditions future states. So I'm more likely to read in that disappointment in the future. So what we get with this pattern is that we're standing in a hall of mirrors, right? Just about everything that we interact with, Everything that we perceive is a product of previous experiences. And it's reflecting some aspect of ourself back at us. So those reflections of ourselves bounce back at us from others, from situations, from kind of broader narrative arcs that we make up more cognitively. When we're responding to these from ignorance, then suffering is going to appear. You know? Shout out to the 12-fold chain of dependent origination. This hall of mirrors that we find ourselves in is not inevitably karmically conditioned, right? That's why we're here, really. But it often is. The times that we can perceive without the weight of karmic conditioning pushing us are, you know, the very simple, the very sublime experiences in which reality doesn't relate to us, right? The me in the situation isn't that apparent, and it's bare perception, it's pure activity happening. There's nothing for the rest of the world to relate to in that moment. So during experiences like that, it's pretty matter of fact, right? It's unadorned. There's probably some quality of noticing, you know, maybe a quality of crispness or newness or something like that. I basically like it. But it's understated. Often when we're imagining what that's going to be like, we blow it up, we add technicolor, we do something extra. After that experience is when we decide that, oh, I really like that, right? And we grasp onto it, we make it about me, we try to figure out how we happened into that state, and then we try to get back to it. And that's all copy-paste, reacting with karma. And suddenly the simple freshness of that experience is buried under, you know, five layers of karma. So this hall of mirrors is a bummer, but it's also useful, right? If we want to be free, our method in this tradition is of noticing the mirrors with mindfulness and compassion, right? Bringing our attention to that quality of mirror and sustaining that attention, having a vividness of that attention, and having a benevolence to it. So Zen, as a method of training the mind, in order to express enlightenment, is this whole labyrinth of mirrors, right? Everything's pointing back. You know, the forms that we hold here in the Zendo, the schedule, the when and where we bow, what it all looks like, the rows are in straight lines. It's all ways of noticing who we are, because as we express the forms, we're displaying aspects of ourselves. And it's easier to see them when they're contrasted with everyone else's expression of those same forms. Right? There's a sameness overall, and so our individuality stands out. Easier to catch. We see that not just contrasting ourselves against the group, but also contrasting ourselves against ourself over time. You know, how I bow is different day by day, and that gives me information. How we relate to an altar or an image of the Buddha, right? There's probably a response, a behavioral change in terms of how we think, how we hold the body, how we move, you know, what the situation means to us. And that's mostly our projection of what practice means to us. You know, we're just layering it there on the altar, on the Buddha figure. Because if we're perceiving without that conditioning, without that layering, then all that's there is, you know, shape and color. That's very simple. There's no catches there until we add them. There might be a faint degree of like or dislike, right? Vedana level, very, very subtle. So forms are a mirror. Meditation's also a mirror, you know, shikantaza. When there's no input but the activity of the mind projected on this canvas in front of us, the screen of our awareness, there's nothing but that mirror. Watching this activity during Zazen makes it simpler because there's nothing else that's adding. You know, we're the only ones projecting images in that moment. But, you know, most of us have spent a fair amount of time in Zazen, and most of us can to attest that it's pretty difficult. If we're drawn into the story, if we believe what's projected on that screen, then we're not generating that sustained, vivid, benevolent attention that's needed. We're instead sitting there rehearsing karmic loops. Being part of Sangha is a mirror. It's a way of helping us, making it easier for us to see ourselves by borrowing different perspectives. It's all still a mirror, it's all projection, but we're incorporating other views, right? It's not just how I see myself, but I'm noticing my perception of how others see me. And over time, as we, you know, commit more, offer more to the Sangha, those other views, those, like that kind of triangulation of who I am becomes more trusted. We can put more weight there. And it makes it easier to see our see past our own version of who we are and to release that belief in the story as how it actually is. That interpersonal mirroring, that phenomenon of reflection, is intensified when we're around seniors, when we're in Sanzen or within a teacher-disciple relationship. This is something that we get a lot of mileage out of in Zen. The tradition is passed down, face to face, warm heart to warm heart, mind to mind. I hope it doesn't have to be passed down screen to screen, but for now it's convenient. In these kinds of more intimate, more intensive relationships, we're offering more leverage to the other perspective. We tend to add more projection, right? Anybody who has spent some time around here knows that those relationships are ripe for adding our own stuff to it. You know, we can see the ripples there. We're pretty conditioned to fill in empty spaces. Right, so if the altar is not giving us anything, if our teacher isn't saying something, we fill it in. Right, we want to make meaning out of it, and so if it's unclear or if it's vast, and we're not in a vast state ourselves, you know, we're making up that meaning out of our conditioning. One thing that I'm curious about with our Sangha is that we have an interesting phenomena right now in that we have a lot of seniors bumping around who are not actively in teacher-student relationships. All right, there's, you know, Kyogen died, and gradually over time his disciples have found or failed to find other strategies for meeting the needs that he filled for them. You know, they've found other teachers, or they've paused in practice, or they've incorporated you know, inspiration from other traditions, or they've, you know, had a more diffuse relationship with the Sangha, you know, getting inputs from multiple sources. You know, there's lots of good answers to that. But that's something. And Gyoko has retired, and so it's not as obvious a transition because she's still visible, she's still directly accessible. But many of her disciples have navigated or are navigating the same koan. So there's a little kind of driftiness in the ether on that front for people who have been practicing here in the Sangha for, you know, more than a decade, say. You know, fortunately, happily, with, you know, once you have a decade of practice, chances are you're more resilient and more resourceful and can offer more of that to yourself. But not all of it. You know, our capacity for self-deception, our capacity for, you know, defense strategies kind of taking over is endlessly impressive. So my curiosity is that I'm, you know, for these folks with less than a decade of experience who are, you know, finding their way into practice, and you know, how are they affected by this phenomenon of kind of driftiness, where a fair number of seniors don't have an active teaching relationship? There's also a good number of transplants, folks who are senior in other sanghas who have moved to Portland, and their primary teacher or their root teacher is not in the sangha. So they're in the mix, they're practicing, but that primary relationship is elsewhere or diffuse again. So I don't see that as a problem, but I do see it as a subtle effect on the culture, and it changes the norms, it changes the expectations, and I notice my not knowing about that. That particular kind of mirroring. I suspect one of the challenges that we're finding in maintaining our practice right now during this the COVID ongo is that we're not getting that particular mirroring as frequently, right? We don't have the opportunity for that kind of feedback to happen casually, to happen routinely. And so, you know, and that's regulating, you know, where there's, when we have access to the Sangha in that way, there's wholesome walls to bounce off of. So hopefully you're finding that in your current situations, however that's constituted. So lots of ways in which Soto Zen offers that mirroring to ourselves, that we can see ourselves more clearly. And so in that process of seeing ourselves more clearly, if we don't want our sankharas to vipalka, to fruit, if we want to see through that hall of mirrors, what then? Right? So that's, you know, Dogen said, that's where we turn the light around to shine within. That's venturing into the dragon's cave. That's chopping down the flagpole. It's a in Ananda's chapter of the Denko Roku. It's this process of renunciation, of using our awareness to release the subtle self-centeredness that happens, ignorance, which is most everything, right, we encounter, we know. We just finished last week, the week before, a 10-week series seminary class on the Wisdom Sutras. These are the Buddhist teachings on emptiness, the second turning of the wheel. The Heart Sutra is a short example of a Wisdom Sutra, but there's lots of other ones, Diamond Sutra, etc. So the first turning of the wheel is all of the Buddha's original teachings, right? Those lists that are most famous, right? Those are all part of that first turning. And it's these teachings are basically pointing out that everywhere we think we see self, it's actually mind. And that imagining self where there's just mind leads to suffering. And so far in this Dharma talk, that's mostly what I've been talking about, is how we attribute more permanence, more self, more independence to what's actually just phenomena, just appearance. The second turning of the wheel says that not just that self is empty, but that everything's empty. All those reflections we cherish and those we shy away from, they don't reflect anything, right? There's no referent. And it's a big enough statement, it's a sweeping enough statement to say that the path itself is empty. So that our attempts to understand it more clearly, to move along this path, are actually getting in the way. And then ends, which puts us in a real bind, right? And then the third turning of the wheel accepts the truth of the first two and sort of synthesizes them, reconciles them. So yes, there's no self. Yes, the mind is empty. And mind is also radiant. Mind is also luminous. Mind is also the birthplace of the Buddha. So for our purposes today, the offering of the second turning of the wheel is that this hall of mirrors is empty, and not just empty by circumstance, that seeing our reflection is a shortcut, but like vastly, hugely, irreconcilably empty. And as we kind of get close to that, as we hold that, it's scary. But if we concede that point here and there, if we can accept that at times and moments, we can release some of our projections. We can undo some of them. And not just the ones that we've generated, but also those that we've inherited from beginning of this time, and those that we pick up from the broader society around us, right? Generational delusions, cultural delusions, political delusions. Ultimately, it's all luminous. We don't get to see that luminosity until we strip away the belief. Every place we land, every image we construct, it's used in a provisional way. It has no reference. There's nothing actually there. So right now we're all, you know, in process of navigating the, you know, COVID-19, the impacts of that on the world around us. There are all these, you know, pretty coarse delusions floating about. It's just the flu, or it's all a hoax, or the world's going to end, or I'm on vacation and it's a karma-free zone. You know, I've heard versions of all those. I'm sure most of us have. And there's also, those are pretty, like, you know, obvious, of course, versions, but there's also much more subtle ones, sophisticated ones, like, I'll be safe if, right? You know, we make up our own story there. But we don't really know. And the reason we don't really know is not a lack of information, but because there's no real knowing of what is essentially empty. That's important. So confronted with that no real knowing, we sift through our perceptions, our projections, and we do the best we can. We catch the coarse ones, we don't do those, we mediate the effects of the more subtle ones. We try to find as many opportunities for sustained, vivid, benevolent attentiveness so that we get real glimpses of the hall without mirrors. You see through to the end. recognizing it as empty doesn't mean ignoring it. You know, that's true with COVID-19, that's true with stoplights, right? Just because they're red, I mean, just because red is empty doesn't mean that we fly through them. You know, we treat this situation with respect, we're extra mindful of our hands and faces, but catching the projections as projections, recognizing it as appearance on a mirror, we can also be mindful about ripening all those extra sankhara into that have to do with survival or fear, right? We can treat the situation with respect, but do it with grace and simplicity. So that's part of the gift of the third turning. If we misunderstand the second turning about emptiness, we might ignore stoplights, right? Nothing matters. We drift towards quietism or we drift towards nihilism because it's all empty. And then the third turning provides these guide rails which help keep us on track. So we move through the day, we see some headline. Suddenly we're in a hall seeing a mirror. We remember mindfulness and lean towards this sustained, vivid, benevolent attention. We remind ourselves that what we're perceiving is image, is reflection, is empty. It has no referent. And what's happening here in this process of bringing mindfulness, bringing awareness of emptiness to, you know, a scary headline or whatever, someone speaking in front of you, it could be anything. A red light. As we do this mindfully, the subject changes. Right? At first we're seeing, say, threat to my health, right? That's what's appearing in that mirror. As we remember emptiness, we know intellectually that doesn't quite make sense. It's not the whole story. If we can hold on to that for a couple of moments with some level of clarity and some level of openness, that subject threat to my health recedes into the background. And what takes its place is not all the way real, right? Something like that. That not all the way real comes more into focus. And what's happening is that the emptiness of the situation is becoming more interesting to us than the mirage of it. So that's difficult work, right? Turning the light within, dragon's caves, chopping down flagpoles. It's all of those are renouncing the assumption that we exist as separate, right? Or that which seems separate is somehow essential or pivotal or important somehow. As we release that clinging to worldly affairs, while still we can still take care of them, right? We're elevating the aspect of our perception that notices the emptiness, the numinous, the not all the way real part of our experience. And what's really interesting about this is that sankhara of threat to my health, right? The projection, whatever shows up on that screen in front of us. After that moment of mindfulness where the emptiness comes forward, that sankhara of threat to my health is much less likely to show up next time, right? It's much less likely to vikalpa. It's still in the realm of conditioning. That moment of mindfulness is still conditioned, but it's conditioning towards awareness rather than towards delusion, towards suffering. And that's really what our internal practice is offering to the world. That's where I'd like to leave it today. I would love to hear comments and questions and whatever else you may have. Yes, so the best way for this to happen is to turn the chat on. It's on the bottom of the screen, and then type in a little missive. Or folks in the room can jump in. I missed that, Fu. Oh, so.
Takes a little bit of time. Lena, I'm to ask the question, but her question came halfway through. Can you try again, Lena? So when you're writing a question, when you push enter, it will actually send the message. So type all the way until you're finished, and then you can press enter.
Just in case people are having a hard time with this, if you're asking a question, type it in using the chat and then hit enter.
Ember is putting in the question, I appreciate what you said about warm heart to warm heart. Lately, it seems like I'm being met with so many cold hearts, whether it be in person or over the phone or through Zoom. It feels like it's taking everything I have to keep my heart warm when I'm being met with what seems like coldness, distance, anger, fear, or confusion. My question is, does it get easier?
Yeah, so the question, just to summarize, is that, how do we keep that heart warm? Open, vulnerable, when often we're met with states of mind which seem contradictory to that, right? And I would say, this is a time when a lot of people are challenged and there's, more reactivity than normal floating around. And so that may be happening. I'm not perceiving that right now. What I would say though is that when I do perceive that and I feel like my openness is threatened, the first place that I will go there is to find compassion for myself, right? That it's tender to be open and to not have that reflected back towards us. And that self wants to be understood. And so just, offer that warmth, offer that benevolence that like, okay, it's, yeah, that's painful and it's kind of scary and I wish it wasn't like that. You're just acknowledging what it's like to be you in that moment. And if you can do that, you're doing exactly what I'm talking about here, is that you're giving it that sustained attention, right? That you're bringing your mind to it, you're clarifying it, holding it still for a moment so that benevolence, that warmth can land. And if it goes well, if there's enough of those qualities, then that point of tension is going to relax. So that's when you know that was something worked there. Next question. Okay.
So this is from Gabe. You mentioned leaning into the emptiness of a reflection we are experiencing. Can you say anything more about that? It seems easy for me to actually be leaning into escape or avoidance when I try to do something like that.
Yeah. Well, I think it takes a lot of repetition. So I am encouraged to hear that because, you know, that's a common pitfall of attempting that, and it's a near miss, right? So that's that confusion I spoke about of, you know, having some understanding of emptiness, but not, you know, but not integrated. And so we hear the message of nothing matters, right? And there's a big way in which that's true, but we contort that. And, you know, a wholesome holding of that, like we're so rich in meaning. There's so much, like it does matter. And so that's going to be part of it. You know, that's going to be part of like emptiness as it digests, as you practice with it. But you just have to like catch yourself like, oh, I'm driving off the side of the road to the left and it's bumpy over there. And you know, you steer right. And vice versa.
This is from Chris. It's easier to see things in retrospect sometimes, but I worry about copy-pasting. What I mean is, if I look back and notice, oh, that was a karmic knot, and I bet it will come up again, how can I discern between copy-pasting into the next time that knot comes up and meeting it with immediacy?
Good. Yeah, so, you know, learning is valuable, right? Like, it's not a, we want to, you know, we accrue wisdom over time by noticing what goes wrong and by noticing what goes right. And we don't have to spend the same discernment and discovery on the same issue again and again and again. So that's, we don't want to, you know, that like, this is kind of the opposite of what Gabe was talking about, is like there can be a kind of clinging to emptiness in that everything has to be like purely fresh, and like I don't allow that learning. I don't allow the you know, wisdom of experience to happen. I think what we're looking for in adding that emptiness perspective is, it's not the opposite of like, it's a little bit different part of the process, really. So like time wise, it's a different step. So I think you know, if you're in a difficult situation, you remember last week when you were in a similar difficult situation, right? You can incorporate that and then look for the emptiness, right? It's, you still want to see past it, but you don't have to be, you don't have to like create this artificial naivete around it. And if you are caught by that, I think you can bring in past experience without bringing in the same amount of like emotional energy, reactivity, clinging to it. And that's really what the emptying, like bringing in the emptiness perspective is pulling that, those traces off, not getting rid of the whole impact of prior experience.
This is from Carl. He says, can you please elaborate on the topic of direct experience as being true reality and how that relieves suffering?
Yeah, well, first off, I'll say be careful of true reality, right? Because right. That too is a mirror. But I would say that there's something about bare experience which we recognize as being different and bare sensation. So it's like first nen into second nen, right? Where life is really simple and clear. And in those moments, right, like there's not, we're not feeling the weight of like who we are. We're not feeling that obligation of relating in a particular way, right? There's more access to like a naturalness.
So Lena says, regarding your musing in the Dharma talk about senior teachers, I have noticed a personal curiosity of wondering how senior teachers engage in their own disciple-teacher relationships, sometimes wishing for more modeling of how these relationships can develop, and also recognizing that ultimately this is my own process. But it does somehow lend to an overall feeling tone of a more lightly worn path in regards to our lineage in comparison to other communities. In some ways, I feel like it creates an opportunity for more diversity of expression of Dharma and Sangha.
I'm not sure I understand that question, so I'm gonna make a guess. the senior teacher part was confusing. That's okay. Let me just take a. Okay. Well, great. Nothing to see here.
Sokuchu is saying, while holding the real suffering of the world, I'm grateful for this opportunity to dive headfirst into the no real knowing of what is essentially empty. It feels odd to be grateful, and yet I realize that suffering and freedom are intertwined.
Yeah. I think gratitude is a really natural response to feeling that.
Can I ask a question? Hafnia, what do you mean true reality is another mirror?
So question, what do I mean that true reality is another mirror? So that was referencing Carl's question. And so what that means is that we're perceiving it, right? We're representing that. And so that representation is off, you know, it's incomplete. It's not the whole picture. And, you know, that's always going to be the case. So, you know, that's the finger pointing to the moon. There's a, as long as we keep that in mind, that, you know, we're embodied in a dualistic world, you know, like this is, it's a tough route to meeting reality, in an uninhibited way. And so that like kind of sheen of there's something extra is always going to be there, but that's not, it doesn't have to be an obstacle, right? It feels like it's going to be an obstacle, but it doesn't have to be.
Thomas is asking, tell us more about being in the hall without mirrors.
Well, that's kind of what Carl was asking about, is this moments where we're not adding anything to it, when our sankhara conditioning is not in play, and there's simple perception.
Linda is asking, is this suffering or is this a teaching of impermanence of all things?
Both. every Dharma talk is partaking of some mix of, anicca, anatta, and dukkha. And really, there's all these different ways to dress it up, but that's the subject matter. That's what we're talking about in Buddhism. And we've come at it from, hopefully a lot of different angles and with a lot of different, subject matter, but that's really what we're talking about. And so I think in any given Dharma talk, you'll be able to pull those marks out of it.
David is asking, is emptiness experienced as a kind of distancing or a kind of intimacy?
Well, I wouldn't want to constrain our experiencing that much. I think, both are true. I would say people often relate to a construction of emptiness as void, as other, as annihilation. That's common. It's also true that it's quite common for people to construe emptiness as like the way out, or a get out of jail free card, or something liberative. And I think that both are too simple.
Don is asking, I have been struck with being surprised at times by realizing how I have zero control of what will happen. Is being caught up with a sense that I have to figure out what should happen part of the delusion I should be letting go of? Mm-hmm. I am on the right track when I realize my complete powerlessness of this massive change in our reality.
I think that depends on, speaking to the room, I would say that depends on your karmic conditioning. Speaking to Anand, I would say yes. Yeah, sure, that's something you do. Great to see through that. and have more flexibility with how that rolls out. Yeah.
And Sally is asking, if we can't know anything empty, what can we know? Even Buddha nature is empty.
Which Sally is that? So say it one more time.
Oh, it's Chico. If we can't know anything empty, what can we know? Even Buddha nature is empty.
Yeah. Well, we certainly can't fix any knowing. We can, we can know this, right, in any moment. We can have that experience completely. We can have a immediate embodied knowing. But that doesn't last, That was that. And now we have to do it over.
She writes back, I'm thinking of the Buddha's all knowledge.
Sure. all right. Any last chance? All right.